Well, it's Richard Mackey with the UBC Law History Project and Graham Zilm. It's the 18th of January 2003, and we're talking to Lynn Smith. Good afternoon, Lynn.
Hello.
Hello.
2013, I think.
Did I say three?
I like to lose a decade every once in a while.
Thank you. The time flies. So you're an Albertan originally, is that right?
Yes.
Could you talk about your early life a bit and your early education? And
sure.
Then we'll perhaps take it from there.
Sure.
Thank you.
I grew up in Calgary, Alberta. I went to public schools. My high school was called Central High School. It was thought to be the academic high school in the city. It's not there anymore. I went to the University of Calgary, as it was then called the University of Alberta at Calgary. There was a movement for autonomy, and it became autonomous by the time I was in third or fourth year, I can't remember. I did an honors degree in philosophy, meaning I did a four-year degree involving a thesis. I enjoyed philosophy very much. After I graduated, after I graduated, I joined the Company of Young Canadians, and I worked in a social housing project as a volunteer. The Company of Young Canadians was a Trudeau initiative meant to be a kind of internal Peace Corps, and so a domestic Peace Corps. People were posted to northern communities, reservations, and so on. I was posted to a social housing project in downtown Vancouver and worked at community organizing and assisting people in gaining a voice in that community. For a year, I then worked at International House as the secretary for CUSO, Canadian University Services Overseas. And then I worked on a film, one of the first feature films made in Vancouver. After that, I traveled for a year in Europe. During that period of time, I wrote the LSAT in Florence. and it was the first year that UBC was having students write the LSAT, but it was on a trial basis, so it didn't actually count. And I applied for law school. I was admitted. UBC was the only school I applied to. I came back and started first year in, 1970.
Can I ask you if those are all interesting episodes, and I was wondering what was your thesis about in philosophy?
The prevailing school of thought in the University of Calgary Department of Philosophy was British analytic philosophy, meaning Wittgenstein, Austin, Urmson, Bertrand Russell, people like that. And the typical philosophical question would be the meaning of a word, like the meaning of intention. So my thesis was on what it means to do something on a whim. So I was trying to unpack the concept of whim, in particular asking whether there was how important intention was when we think about what we mean by that word. So less useful.
But it sounds very kind of late 60s, hippie-ish almost.
No. These were all very proper. No, these were all very proper British German faculty members.
So it wasn't some measure of spontaneity or.
Well, maybe, the faculty wasn't like that really. It was pretty British, I'd say, not 60s invasion British.
No. So, I was pretty young, but I think on a whim you could go traveling, you could join a commune, you could move cities. So it didn't have anything to do with the social currents at the time.
Not really, no. I mean, I just found it interesting. I don't know why, but I did, and that was what my thesis was. So the that was my I thought about going on into graduate work in philosophy, but decided against it for a number of reasons, one of which was I wanted to do something a little bit closer to the ground. And so going into this domestic Peace Corps, the company of young Canadians, seemed like a good idea. I liked the idea of being able to maybe help make things better. Hadn't thought about going to law school, really, except on and off. I had thought about it when I was in high school and whatnot, but there were no lawyers in my family. I didn't know any lawyers. They were a foreign species, really. One of my classmates' his father was a judge, and we did have a tour of the courthouse under the auspices of his father one day, but that was it. That's all I knew. And so I can't tell you what eventually led me to get the application forms and apply to go to UBC Law, but I did, and entered first year.
And the company of young Canadians sounds a bit like the those other social programs of the Trudeau era. One of them I vaguely remember is the LAP grants,
right?
The LIP grants,
right?
Where were you? You said you were with a at a social housing project. Was that where?
Actually, it was several. Raymer, which is in the downtown east side, Skeena, which is near Burnaby, still in Vancouver, and Little Mountain. We worked with those three projects. There were several of us assigned to that particular project. One of them had graduated in economics, and after the CYC went on to have a very distinguished civil service career in federal government.
Who was that?
Oh, her name's Maeva Hansey. I left out one interesting, I suppose, part of what I did when I was in university. I had the opportunity to travel a bit because, right after high school, I had the opportunity to travel to France because of the Lions Club. The Lions Club of Calgary had an essay contest, which I decided to enter, and I was fortunate enough to win. And so I won this essay contest, and the prize was you can spend the summer with the Lions Club of your choice. So I chose Paris, and that was really fun. That was the first time I'd been on a plane, and it was the first time I'd been east of the Saskatchewan border, and suddenly there I was in Paris.
What year was that?
1964, I think, something like that.
So you knew Europe before you knew Eastern Canada.
Oh, absolutely. I thought it was great. And I had enough French that I could manage. And so then my French got a fair bit better from being in Paris for the summer, and I also took a course there. So then the next year, the World University Service was putting together one of its seminars. The World University Service used to have annual summer seminars where a student from each university in Canada, in the case of the larger university, several students, would go to a developing country. And the developing country in 1964 or 65, I guess it was 64 was Algeria and 63 might have been Paris. Was Algeria. So I went on an 8 weeks trip to Algeria with students from across the country and faculty members. And it was just an amazing opportunity. We met the president of Algeria, and we went around the country. We met students. We took part in cultural events. I met all kinds of people from Quebec and the Maritimes. Really got to know Canada in a different way through being with all these other students. And there were some people who went on to great heights from that seminar. Beverly McLaughlin was one. She was from the University of Alberta the seminar.
She was later here at the law.
Yes, that's right.
Taught here, but she wasn't a student.
She didn't go here. No, she went to the University of Alberta. And Raymond Chrétien, who was later the ambassador to the U.S. and
The brother of
the Prime Jean. Minister, okay. Yeah. And David Dodge, who was later the Bank of Canada governor. It was quite a group. Of course, everybody was a grubby student at the time. But it was, it just goes to show it was interesting people and a wonderful opportunity. So that opportunity to travel was terrific because living in another culture for a while, whether it was France or then Algeria, it certainly did allow me to, be willing to think about the world in a bigger way than maybe you do if you grow up in a small Alberta city. Mm-hmm. Well, it was small then.
And it was a French colony, Algeria, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So you could use your...
It had only recently become independent. There'd been a war, and they'd thrown out the French 4 years earlier, maybe. But there were still areas where you couldn't go because there were still landmines. Mm-hmm. And there was still bomb damage and a lot of scars. And while we were there, actually, there was a sabotage, and an ammunition ship was blown up in the harbor of the city we were in. An enormous explosion. Hundreds of people were killed. And we had some medical students with our group, and they went down and helped out. The rest of us stayed out of the way, which was the best thing to do.
Well, Algeria's in the news right now with this hostage-taking at an oil refinery.
Mm-hmm.
The
fundamentalist movement didn't exist then, mm-hmm. right? It was all about anti-colonialism, and I suspect that the society was freer then than it is now. Women were being encouraged not to wear veils, rather than forced to, and there was quite an opening to the world. But
why would that be a anti-colonial? You would think in an anti-colonial era, you would turn your back on the West, hadn't it sunk in yet?
It didn't play out that way, at least in Algeria. It was about being a Mediterranean country on its own right, as opposed to an appendage of France. But how can I speak for the Algerians of that era? But my sense was that they did not feel that they had to be fundamentalists in any religious terms in order to reject the ways of the West. And in fact, Ben Bella, who was the president, it was a socialist government. They were probably atheistic, if anything. So that's far away from UBC law, but anyway.
Well, but it shows what can happen when you get involved in student events,
right.
Student societies,
mm-hmm.
student politics. In fact, we've heard that again and again in the interviews. People mm-hmm. whose political career started early on. I was one of those kind of bookish, lethargic students. But what about the? I was going to ask about the film you worked on as a student.
Well, it was a young independent filmmaker. It was his name's Morey Ruvinsky. He's working in Hollywood now, writing stuff for TV series, I believe. It was called The Plastic Mile. And in those days, it was such a novelty for anybody to be making a film that you could get whatever you wanted. For example, you could say, we would like the Broadway and Granville intersection to be closed down for 2 hours on a Sunday morning, please. You couldn't do it. It was a different world. People would lend you things, houses, furniture. Nobody expected to be paid. It was all for the glory of being in a film. did the film ever go anywhere? No. It was shown at a film festival, but I think that was about it.
And it was a summer job?
It wasn't a job at all. Everybody was a volunteer working on this exciting film. I had many titles. I was a director's assistant, continuity, I think I had responsibility for costumes as well. I can't remember. I was kind of the behind the scenes working with the director person. But it was a lot of fun. But, it, you know, no money was made. There was some notion that we would be recompensed when the movie made lots of money, but of course that didn't happen.
So what actually brought you to Vancouver? It wasn't law school. It was the...
It was the Company of Young Canadians, really. Yeah. You would apply to join this organization, and then once you had joined, they decided where you could do the most good. And in my case, they thought Vancouver, which was fine with me. I was happy to try a different city.
Mm-hmm. And the reasons for law school, you said they were quite vague. When did you actually have the impulse? When did you know?
Well, this isn't very interesting. I would have said sometime about the year before I applied, but then for some reason I was looking at my junior high school yearbook a while ago, and there it was. I said I wanted to be a lawyer, which I'd completely forgotten, but the idea was there. I became interested in law because I was interested in social change, and I could see the law as a means to get to that end. It was the time of a lot of political turmoil. I was involved in the anti-Vietnam movement. I was involved in the feminist movement. There was an organization called the Vancouver Status of Women that I worked with a lot in those years before I went to law school. So, those sorts of ideas were there. And it didn't seem to be a bad fit, because training in philosophy, at least the kind of philosophy that I trained in, is a lot to do with wordsmithing and deciphering the meaning of terms, thinking hard about language, and practicing law is a good deal about that, actually.
And the Vancouver Status of Women, I've had a student and another, I teach writing occasionally, a woman named Glenda Sutherland.
Yeah.
Who's writing her memoirs. Of that time. She was the host of a show called Woman Alive, or was it Women mm-hmm. Alive? Mm-hmm. And she's talked a lot about, I think, Rosemary Brown was one.
Rosemary
of
was a good friend. Yeah.
So were you a volunteer on that?
Yeah. No, we're not talking about any money being made here. Yeah. How did I survive? I don't know. Well, I worked at International House. And then while I was away, I think I'd saved up some money and just traveled around, as students do. And it was the Vancouver Women's Caucus, actually. That was the other one. Status Women, Vancouver Women's Caucus. That was it. And, the anti-war people were very active at that time.
Mm-hmm. And there were lots of draft dodgers, war resistors.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So the political community was quite rich.
Mm-hmm. And fertile, what's the word? Mm-hmm. With the incoming... with the counterculture, mm-hmm. I suppose, and the mm-hmm. and the back to the land movement was, mm-hmm. of course, you can't have a back to the land movement in a city, but urban.
Some tried.
Urban agriculture. I guess you've got all those backyards. And so you wrote the LSAT in Florence. That's mm-hmm. a story. That mm-hmm. sounds like there's a story there.
Well. I think it's still the case, but they offered the opportunity to write the LSAT all kinds of places, London, Florence, and so on, and I happened to be in Florence. What was startling about the experience was how experienced the Americans were at writing these kinds of tests. They seem to have spent their lives preparing for and writing these kinds of tests, the SAT, and others, and then the LSAT. So they had been studying and prepping, and I just didn't have a clue. I had the booklet. I had a small notion of what might be involved. Just walked in and did it. It was an interesting experience. Oh, the fact was it didn't count, and I knew that.
Did the questions, were they kind of open-ended? Did you have a chance to put in, to write down any of these, of the experiences you've been having?
Oh, no. It's a multiple choice sort of intelligence test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I assume it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Or it's probably changed very little.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's no open-ended question whatsoever. So it's about logic, vocabulary. For a while there was a general knowledge component, but I think they've taken that out now, haven't they?
It wasn't on my LSAT.
Yeah. But it's, it's questions like, if you're going to seat 10 people at the table and you can't seat X next to Y, but you can seat Z next to A, and B, can't have anyone sitting, how do you, that kind of question.
Hmm.
What does that have to do with practicing law?
Yes.
You're asking yourself.
That's what I was thinking. Okay, how can I be? My exams were all in history, so I got used to writing essays and essay after essay. But we did talk to two people, Stuart Rush was one, and Carrie Lynn, who were opposed to the LSAT, and who saw it as part of American imperialism, a branch of the an American institution that was being imposed on Canada.
Well, I did learn a lot more about the LSAT later when I joined the law faculty, because so that was in 1981 when I joined the law faculty, 82. Because after not too long, I was asked to be the UBC representative on the Law School's Admissions Council Test Questions Review Committee. Mm-hmm. And what that was a committee of law professors from across North America who reviewed the questions that were going to go on LSATs. So the wizards at the Educational Testing Service of Princeton, New Jersey would come up with draft questions, and they'd go through this panel of law professors. And I then went on to be on the board of the Law School's Admissions Council and learned a lot more about it. And actually, the American thing was very interesting because early on, as I mentioned, there was a general knowledge section on the test, and this is when I was just newly on the Test Questions Review Committee. And I found that the questions were completely out of the ken of most Canadians a lot of the time. You know, they were about the Constitutional Convention of whatever, and state capitals, and, much more obscure than that, American general knowledge. And furthermore, the booklet that was sent out to students who were thinking of writing the LSAT had on the cover, it had a screaming eagle and a great big American flag, and I think maybe Mount Rushmore, I don't know. It had these extraordinary symbols. So I wrote a letter to the chair of the board and the president saying, well, now we are using the LSAT in Canada. How about adding Princess Diana and Niagara Falls or something? You know, let's try to mix this up a bit. And they thought it was terribly amusing and cheeky. But, I think that Stuart and Mr. Lindy had some point about the American scientific thing, particularly so when they had American general knowledge questions. I mean, now that those are gone, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that it goes to reasoning and logic skills. Hard to say that it's, it's particularly close to any national identity anymore.
Mm-hmm. So it's more generic now.
Very generic.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to law school, and it'd be interesting to hear what you have, your memories of that, I forgot to ask you about your parents. Their professions, their influence, that kind of thing.
My mother mainly didn't work outside the home, and my father worked for an automotive wholesaler. So he was a salesman for a while, and then after that he worked in the warehouse. Worked at the same company for his whole life. And neither of them particularly aspired for me to be a lawyer. It was not, those were the days when, you know, it was get married or, you know, teacher, nurse.
Secretary.
Yeah. Yeah. But, they didn't hold me back. They were supportive of my going to university, and they didn't object when I went off to law school, and I think were very proud eventually. They thought it was great. Okay.
And it was the car, the automobile era, so it was a good place for your dad to be working, a good profession.
Sure.
Siblings, did you have?
No, only child.
Ah, right. So you're in Florence, and you did the exam, and then where were you when you found out that you had got in? Well, I suppose that's a they might have let you in anyway, even without the LSAT, right?
Yeah, what they were doing was having a group of applicants write the LSAT. They were not going to take it into account, but they then looked at performance in first-year law against how people had done on the LSAT. And they found, and this is consistent over decades, that there's a fairly good correlation between performance in law school and LSAT score. And that they found that in our year. So I don't remember where I was when I found out I'd been admitted to law school, but I was admitted and I showed up in the fall. And
is this 1970 now?
70. Yeah, if I graduated in 1973, which I did. Yeah, that's right.
What do you remember of the of the beginning? Where it was here, obviously, but it was one of the earlier.
Yeah.
One of the earlier.
It was in the old building and the huts, the famous huts, no doubt you've heard about.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, of course, I'm sure everybody says this, being totally intimidated and thinking, oh my God, I'm really in the big pond now. This is not going to work out. But it was okay. There were very few women, of course. There were, I think, something like 16 or 17 of us in 225.
Oh.
So it was, I have to check that, but it was that order. And so very few women. We were in sections, four sections, I guess. And so you spent a lot of time with the people in your section. What can I say? It was first year law.
Did all 16 or 17 of the women graduate?
I think so. I don't remember any of the women dropping out. I think we did. Now, one of us actually sadly died a couple of years after she graduated, but soon after graduation. But I think, yeah, everybody got through.
And who?
I think.
Who were some of your friends? Who were the other?
Well, Marguerite Jackson and Penny Bain were friends and classmates that I hung out with. Judy Clark. And then the study group I found myself in included Steve Kelleher and Stane Goodman Seth and John Sigurdsson.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? Sometimes Rick Gopel. There was kind of a movable study group. Oh yeah, Brian Adams, not the singer. Brian Adams. And and so the study group became quite close, and people did a lot of things together. People did tend to get to know others in their section because you took all your classes in the same section.
And what? So the study group was from your
section. In the main. I think we maybe involved a few other people, but I can't remember for sure. And we would course, this was before laptops or anything, so it's all handwritten notes, and we'd all have our handwritten notes. People with neat handwriting, like Steve Kelleher, were very popular. I had neat handwriting, too, but I would sometimes get distracted and edge off into doodling, so my notes weren't as beautiful as some others.
Graham is the only person left in his year, is that right?
There's a couple still who are holding on to a pen.
Yeah. I've thought a lot about note-taking. I mean, because when you're sitting as a judge, you can take notes in your lovely bench book, which has 8.5 by 14-inch paper, beautiful quality paper. You can use your nice pen. It's all very aesthetic. But if you use your laptop, you can watch the witnesses a lot better. Mm-hmm. So I thought about that. But I certainly have a lot of time for the idea that note-taking works better when you're using your hand, because you have to be more succinct. You're not just trying to be a stenographer.
One of the similar reasons that I keep notes that way is,
yeah,
I also find it, you know, that succinctness and that process of taking what a person has said, mm-hmm, and transcribing it into some form of notes, mm-hmm, I feel that helps me not just remember it, but process it and analyze it to a certain extent.
I agree.
Other people prefer to type, but also I never started doing it, so I don't see any reason to change. My grades were decent. Why mess with what I'm doing?
Exactly. You're here.
Did you work in the library? Did you do lots of library work too? I suppose you must have to look up cases and precedents.
Oh, yes. And there was a beautiful reading room in the library. The main reading room had this view, but on the main floor. Sweeping view. You'd sit there and look at the eagles, the sky. It was lovely. The only thing was, smoking was allowed everywhere in those days, including in the library. And even though I was a smoker, I hated it. But, yeah, worked in the library. I joined the law review end of first year. And so I would work in the library, or I'd work in the law review office.
Now, that, I don't think we've heard about the law review. What is it? How does it work?
Well, the UBC Law Review is a student-edited law review that publishes peer-reviewed articles. At the time that I was in first-year law, there was a professor named Jim Matkin, who had come from the United States, where there's a lot of prestige about being on the law review. If you're on the Harvard Law Review, it's a big deal. You know, you're godly, practically. So he wanted to make the UBC Law Review that kind of publication that would have a lot of prestige. So he wanted to bring more people in, and so he went out and recruited some of the students in first year that he thought were perhaps suited to do law review work, and Steve Kelleher and I and Stan Gooden and Seth and a couple others joined, and we ended up being the editors. Steve and Stan and I, we decided to be a trio of editors, which was unusual. We were called the Troika. And so I was on the Law Review for all 3 years. I wrote a couple of pieces for it, which were published. My first published article was a case comment on a Supreme Court of Canada case called La Voix, and then the second published article was called Finding Articles in British Columbia or something like that, Sex Discrimination. It was about the history of women in the legal profession, and then a survey that I had a couple of friends who were social scientists, mm-hmm, and so my social scientist friends and I put together a survey that went out to students who were looking for articles. I can't remember which year it was, like 1972 or 73. We got the responses and processed them and made some findings. Turned out that the women who were looking for articles, when you controlled for marks, got considerably fewer offers than the men did. Kelsey Priese.
Yeah. Well, we heard, we've talked to one or two older women who were on the, who practiced, and we've heard that they had a more of a struggle getting mm-hmm. articles. This is even in the 50s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Girls of Peace, exactly.
One woman who was a friend of Staines applied to a large Vancouver firm. Now, she was not a UBC student. She was from, I think, the University of Ottawa. But she applied to a large Vancouver firm, and she gave the name of a reference. And her reference got a letter back saying, "Dear so-and-so, while Ms. X seems to be highly qualified and would be a great article student, we've already hired a woman this year. And so we're not going to be offering her an interview." And so she launched a human rights complaint.
Yeah.
And another law student and I represented her, in quotes, in the human rights complaint. Which, it was very interesting. It was good experience.
You'd think they would have spent a minute to think of a different excuse
But it was a different era. It seemed perfectly sayable to the lawyer who wrote it at that time.
So what did you do with the, I forget the word you just used, when you complained about this?
Well, she launched the complaint,
mm-hmm.
and another law student and I represented her in that because she wasn't here. She was in Central Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So we processed it. We followed up with the investigating officer. We went to the hearing and represented her. We met with the senior partner of the firm. And in the end, the senior partner apologized and offered her a job.
Hmm.
But she was in the happy position of being able to say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I've already accepted another offer." So it was nice.
So in that case, change just required you just needed to call them on it and appeal to their better qualities, I suppose.
Well, I'm not sure. There was a considerable period of non-response and foot-dragging, and there was considerable discussion about whether they'd come to the hearing or should we all meet at their office. There was a great deal of denial.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, I think the possibility of being embarrassed about it, you know, if there had been any publicity, which there wasn't, it wouldn't have been something that they would have wanted to see publicized, I wouldn't think.
Could that have gone to the, is it the Law Society that has the governing board of the...
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I cover that in that article. There was an opinion that the benchers of the Law Society had received, to the effect that it was not contrary to the rules of the Law Society to discriminate in hiring for articles. And the reasoning was that articling students were apprentices, and apprentices were excluded from the human rights legislation. And therefore, there was nothing sideways about it. Now, that was astonishing. And the opinion that the benchers went on was that it wasn't contrary to the human rights legislation to explicitly discriminate based on race or sex or anything. And B, they refused to pass a rule that would make it unprofessional conduct. I was part of a committee that the benchers set up. I was the student representative. And part of our committee tried to get the Law Society to pass a rule that would make it unprofessional conduct to discriminate. And we succeeded up to a certain level, but then we failed, and it didn't get passed. 20 years later, they passed a rule. So, the profession was pretty conservative about these matters.
What was the human rights legislation at the time?
Yeah, good question, because it's gone through so many variations. I think it might have been called the Human Rights Act. There wasn't a human rights tribunal or apparatus or anything. There were just industrial relations officers who worked normally for the Labor Relations Board, but they would come around and investigate human rights complaints as well. And I remember the fellow who investigated my colleague's human rights complaint was he found it quite interesting, and I think he really liked the fact that in the end the firm had to come around. He didn't get to do human rights stuff every day, and he kind of liked it. So, but it was astonishing that the Law Society took the position it did, I must say.
Was that a conservatism or a inertia, or what was the main?
Conservatism, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you were a student still when you did this publication, these two publications.
Right. Right.
That sounds like a very good experience.
Yeah. No, it was. It was. It was a good experience indeed, including working with my two social scientist friends to do that survey and figure out what the results meant. And being an editor in the Law Review was a good experience too, because you'd get submissions from professors or students across the country, and you'd have to decide whether they were publishable and get peer review done, and then do copy editing. And I think Law Review is a great way to learn a lot about being a lawyer, actually.
And it's obviously going still, the UBC
Law
Review?
Yeah.
And is it still run? Do the students have a hand in it still?
Yeah, it's still a student-run publication. With faculty advisors, there are always faculty advisors who students call on. And as I say, peer review, so they send articles out to people blind who are knowledgeable in the field and get them to give a critique and recommend whether it be published or not.
So the students really have to do a lot of, acquire lots of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and lots of legwork, and
mm-hmm.
so it's an apprenticeship, it sounds like, in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And, again, it's a community. You know, you work with people who are interested in writing and, I suppose, the more academic side of law. And it was a lot of fun. We had a great deal of fun in that Law Review office. And I suppose that's the other benefit, is that there's another place that you can go, your little clubhouse.
Where was it at the law school?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask that. It was somewhere in the... Well, originally it was somewhere in the law building. And then when we were in third year, they started to they started to tear down the old building, and the whole law school moved into Mary Ballard Hall and elsewhere. Some into, what's that building right next door?
Brock?
Brock, yeah.
Brock
some
Hall.
Into Brock. So we were scattered. So to be honest, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. And what professors do you remember who had an influence on you?
Bertie McLean,
mm-hmm.
who taught property law and then became dean. He became dean while we were in law school. So the transition from George Curtis to Bertie McLean took place. And the students had some inkling that something was going on. You know, dean search processes are sort of open now. And, you know, decanal candidates come in and give lectures, and everybody knows what's going on, and there's a student representative on the committee, and so on and so on. I don't believe there was any student representative on the committee. I don't think that had been thought of yet. It wasn't very public. But somehow, you know, word got out. We knew that they were looking for a new dean to replace George Curtis. People came in. I believe Harry Arthurs from York University was one. And Bertie McLean was another. And he became dean and did a lovely job. Wonderful professor. Just a gifted teacher. Gifted. Other wonderful teachers were Leon Getz,
mm-hmm.
Chris Carr, who later went back to the UK. He was about, I don't know, he was about our age. He was about 28 years old when he was teaching, because you get your law degree as a first degree in the UK. It's a true undergraduate degree. So anyway, here he was teaching us but brilliant guy. And he went back to the UK and became a barrister passed away a while ago. But Chris Carr was wonderful. Contract law. Who else did I... Well, Jim Matkin, I thought, was a very interesting professor. He really took a broad approach to the context of the case. He taught constitutional law.
What happened to him? I don't think we've heard about him from...
Well, Jim Matkin has had an interesting career. He went on to be the BC Business Council chair.
Oh, with it. Matkin.
Right.
Yes, I remember that.
Then he went to the Law Society. He was the Law Society secretary for a while. There were no women professors, none. And I don't remember ever reading a judgment by a female judge. So, you know, that fact just tells you how, for I think many women in law school at that time, it felt like entering a very alien place. But at the same time, it's an adventure. I mean, we knew that there were women judges. There was a rumor that there was a woman judge in Ontario, but nobody had ever met one. There weren't any pictures of any in the halls, and I don't think we ever read a decision by a woman.
I was looking on the internet, and I saw the mention of a women's caucus, women in the law group. Were you involved with...
That didn't exist then.
No.
No. Came a bit later.
So it was really you had to be there was a singularity. You had to work on your own as a woman. Right?
You had to have a fairly tough skin.
And other professors, do you remember any? Or contemporaries?
Oh, well, lots of people. I'm just trying to think. I mean, there were so many. My husband accuses me of, seeing one of our former classmates and saying, "Who's that?" But, I do remember a lot of classmates, but nobody particularly stands out besides the ones I've mentioned. I mean, I mentioned Judy Clark and Rick Turner. They ended up being housemates, actually. We had a house full of law students on West 14th. It was kind of fun. The charades tournament was another opportunity for people to enjoy themselves. You would have heard about the trike race, I expect.
Heard of the trike race. I haven't heard of the charades.
Well, for a few years at least, at the same time as the trike race, I think it might have been immediately after or something, there would be a charades tournament. And it was, highly professional charades. People were trained and practiced, and Tom Shorthouse, who was the law librarian, also had another line. He would write the questions for Reach for the Top, the television program. So he came and he was already here, wrote the questions for the charades tournament, and I think was the main judge. So that was a lot of fun.
And that was a law school event.
It was. It was all held in the biggest classroom, maybe in the main reading room of the library. The trike race used to have its start in the main reading room of the library.
And what did you do in the summers during your law years?
So one summer, I continued. I worked part time all the way through law school. At the Vancouver Museum for some of the time. I was a guard.
Yeah.
I guarded the St. Rock, the ship.
Oh, yeah.
You noticed it's still there. I was successful. I think I worked at the Vancouver Museum full-time during one summer. And then the next summer, There was a project. I may be getting summers mixed up. One of the professors, Steve Wexler, got a grant to do a poverty law project. And some of us worked on that project. That was my summer job 1 year. Again, downtown East Side social housing project. And then another summer, the Law Review has a grant that allows the editors to be paid and work for the Law Review over the summer. So I did that 1 year. I think that's about it. I didn't work at a law firm during the summer. That wasn't as common then.
And so did you do well academically? I mean, I've heard people saying they were fifth or 12th, or maybe they don't talk about it, but were you in the kind of, you took your studies seriously?
I did. I was first in first year. And then I think I was fourth in second year and second in third year or something like that. I should be accurate. I think I tied for first in first year. I think that's right.
Wow.
And I think the faculty put great stock, kind of irrationally, in the fact that the fellow that I tied with and I both had the identical LSAT score. I seem to remember that being a...
So were the marks purely, were they based on percentages of written work, or how did they...
Exams. 3-hour exams. First year, it was all exams. Well, maybe that's not quite true. I think maybe there was a paper or two, but very much in the main exams.
And the rankings were all public? They were posted?
They were. It was all very public. Not a good way to do things.
No, I suppose they could put the pressure on people, especially if they didn't do as well as they hoped or expected.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of meaningless. When you've already selected from many applicants to let people into law school, you have a fairly narrow band of people to start with, and to put great stock in fairly insignificant differences. Don't you agree?
More or less, yeah. I'd be fine with them abolishing grades.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
And so articling, right? How did that go? Did you go through with it?
Yes, I did. I applied and was offered a position at Shrum Little in Hebbenton, which was a maybe 15, 16 lawyer firm. I can't remember at the time. It had a good reputation, kind of an up-and-coming firm. Sholto Hebbenton was one of the senior partners. Lovely guy. Had an American law school education and had practiced in New York and put a lot of emphasis on, a more academic approach to law. They supported people who wanted to go off and get their master's degrees, that kind of thing. And Gordon Shrum, who was the son of the Shrum who built Simon Fraser University and so on. Mm-hmm. Anyway, not nice people. And I turned out to be the first woman at that firm. Along with one of my classmates, Penny Bain. We articled at the same time. But partway through my articles, it turned out that the courts in British Columbia had decided to launch a clerkship program. So I was approached to apply for a clerkship with the Court of Appeal, which I did, and I was successful in getting an offer. So I left my articles partway through to be a law clerk for a year, and then after that I came back and finished my articles, and then I stayed on with that firm.
So who were you clerk to?
The Chief Justice of the province, whose name was John Ferris. But I really worked for the whole Court of Appeal. There was just one clerk for the Court of Appeal, that was me, and then there was one clerk for the Supreme Court. And it was really wonderful experience. I learned so much, including a deep appreciation for the difficulty in being a judge. I saw how hard they worked. I saw how they struggled to get it right. It was quite enlightening.
What did you do as a clerk?
I would. So one standard thing was appeals would come in, and when they got set down for hearing, sometime before the hearing, I would write a memorandum summarizing what the appeal was about. So just like a briefing note, what this appeal is about, what the issues are. And I'd do that for every one of the appeals, and then all the judges would get that. So just a handy aid memoir. And then different judges would assign me different research tasks. They'd be working on a judgment about something or other, and they'd ask me, well, could you please have a look at this? And then sometimes there were policy issues or sort of overreaching issues that the Chief Justice would ask me to look at, which I can't discuss because it's all confidential. But
so even now you can't?
No, I mean, well, your work as a clerk is confidential and remains so.
And did you have an office and a... where were the... This was at the law courts downtown?
It was. Now it's now the art gallery. Right. But it was in that building. And, that was the funny thing. Because it was the first year of having clerks, they hadn't figured out where to put us. So they put us into empty judges' chambers. So I was in this enormous marble chamber with a desk, you know, that you could play tennis on practically. It was really quite extraordinary. I've never since had such an office. And the courthouse was sort of open in those days. There wasn't any security in the judges' area. So you see people kind of wandering down the hall, and they glance in the door and see this young woman and see this big double take. What? Surprising I didn't get thrown out. But it was a very good experience. And then I went back and finished my articles at Shrum Little and stayed on, practiced law until I became a partner, and then had two children, and then came and joined the law faculty in 1981. But I taught as an adjunct almost as soon as I was out of law school. I think I started teaching as an adjunct in 1975 or 74, anyway, pretty soon, because they had decided to have a women and the law seminar, and they needed somebody to teach it. So I taught the women and the law seminar in conjunction with other colleagues. Penny Bain for a while. Anyway, I can't remember. Marguerite Jackson. So I'd find a partner, and we'd teach this seminar.
But you did so as an adjunct, not as a regular
correct
faculty. But that was enough to that obviously ticked off that the box for the law school. They were you were providing them with the women's approach. A feminist...
Well, whatever. I mean, it was the Women and the Law Seminar. Mm-hmm. So, but a number of people teach as adjuncts, as you mm-hmm. probably know. Yeah. And then in a year or two, they needed somebody to teach evidence. Mm-hmm. And so I agreed to teach evidence as well as an adjunct. And the firm, to its great credit, thought, well, yeah, this is a good thing. Good for us to be providing this service to the faculty, and it's good training for our lawyer. So I taught evidence, which is a two-unit course, and maybe three-unit. Anyway, evidence is a significant whack of work, plus the Women and the Law Seminar.
What did you practice? What kind of law did you...
Litigation. Mostly civil litigation, but some criminal.
And so this was 1974 to 1981 you mm-hmm. practiced law, and then 1981 you joined the
faculty.
How did that happen? You had been teaching as an adjunct. Did they invite you to be a permanent?
Well, the way it happened was this. As I mentioned, I had two children, and I'd become a partner at Shrum Little. I was enjoying my practice, but I found that it was quite difficult, especially when one of my children had some serious health issues, mm-hmm. to keep everything going. And mm-hmm. so I thought, well, I'll just see if there are some other possibilities out there. And so I looked around a bit, and among other things, I considered the law faculty, and I phoned the then dean, Ken Lissick, and it turned out that they were in the midst of a search process for a new professor, and he said, why don't you send us an application? And I did, and they offered me the job. So that was lovely. It was magical timing. Magical timing and great good fortune.
What did you teach? Did you have to teach something, or did you continue with your evidence?
Oh no! The dean was doing his job of making sure that courses were covered, and yeah. So he said, "We'd really like you to teach property." Okay, I said. So I taught property and civil litigation, evidence. And then I taught different other things. I taught creditors' remedies for a while, family law, the Women and the Law seminar, different things. Typically, a faculty member will teach two courses per term. So those are the four courses that I really had the most to do with: property, civil litigation, evidence. And then later, I took up charter, and I started teaching the course on the charter.
Of course, 1981 is mm-hmm. the year of the charter.
So. Yeah. So when did I start that? Maybe, I can't remember, 85? I can't remember. But I took up the charter, and that became my main research and writing interest.
What about, you were the chair of the Feminist Legal Studies.
I was never the Feminist Legal Studies chair. Oh. No, I raised the money for the Feminist Legal Studies chair.
Sorry. But you were on the board.
Well, I was the dean when I was raising money, okay.
So you were at the, with the Faculty of Law from till 1997, and the last mm-hmm. bit you were 91 to 97, you were the dean.
Right.
How did that happen? Were you associate dean before? Or?
Nope. I don't know. I think people thought that I might be able to do the dean's job, at least in part or to some extent, because I had been fairly active in a number of organizations and had taken leadership roles in them. So I'd I'd been in a large firm. I don't know. Anyway, while I was on the faculty, I had become quite active in the Women's Legal Education and Action Fund. And I had chaired the board, and I chaired the legal committee, and I chaired West Coast Leaf, and had done quite a lot of organizational work in a national organization. I don't know. I don't know why I sort of got tapped to do it, but I did. The people encouraged me to let my name stand, and I didn't really want to. I thought, no, I don't want to do that. I'd rather keep on doing what I'm doing. And they kept saying, no, you've got to do it. You've got to do it. There's nobody else. You've got to do it. So I did.
Was there lots of resistance still to you as a woman in law, or were things changing quickly?
Well, by then, things had changed. I think people were quite keen to try out the idea of a woman dean by then. I mean, in the end, there weren't any other candidates. I suppose maybe that's why I was dean. Nobody else wanted to do it. And I was, you know, I was the first woman dean here, but there had been female deans in other parts of the country. One or two, anyway.
And where, is there anything else you want to say about being a dean? Because it's 6 or 7 years of work. It must have been a huge job.
Yeah, no. Well, it's a very interesting job. I enjoyed the opportunity to work within the university and get to know people across the wider university and the community. I enjoyed the opportunity to try to make the law school a better place and attract more funds, attract more respect within the university, try to get a new building started. That was one of my main focuses, was to persuade the university that even though the building had only been built in the mid-1970s, it was already outmoded and had, in some sense, has been a disaster from the outset. So I campaigned about that. We had a building committee. We had a needs study. We did our best. We did get a new law building onto the university's official list, but then, you know, didn't get the next step. So a great credit to Dean Bobinski for seeing it through, getting that crucial endowment support. The other thing that we did when I was dean is we raised money, as I mentioned, for the chair in feminist legal studies, and we also raised money for the Faculty of Law Endowment. It was the first endowment, I think, first faculty-based endowment in the university, and we were relatively successful. Alumni weren't used to the idea that they might be asked to continue to support the institution, and I think we got them warmed up to the idea. I started a Dean's Advisory Committee, brought in people to help out with that. We started the PhD program. There had been a master's program previously, but we launched a PhD program. We reduced the size of the first year class in order to make room for the PhD program. That was a controversial move, but seemed the right thing to do. I suppose those are the highlights.
Why was the old building a disaster? I mean, I did my PhD in the history department in the Buchanan building, which I think was late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that the old building was very low, like a bunker.
Yep. Well, it was just bad in so many ways. Where to begin? The lack of light, the cutting off of this view, the heating and cooling system never worked. It was built out of concrete, so you couldn't adapt it for people to plug in their laptops. It was ugly. You know, it was a fine example of brutalist architecture. And in fact, there was a move to save the building because of the brutalist architecture element. No, there was. I'm not making that up. It was dark. You'd have students say, I feel as if I spent 3 years in a basement. Did you ever see it?
I did. Well, I had written the LSAT once about 10 years ago when I finished my undergrad and then went off and did something else. And I wrote it in basically the old building back then. Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting building.
Yeah. Yeah. And it developed, and there wasn't much you could do with it because it was so solidly built. It was all this heavy concrete. So you couldn't sort of tear down walls and reconfigure very well. So it was a shame. I mean, it's wasteful to tear down a relatively new building, but it was so important to the reputation of the law school and to the happiness index of the students. Coming back, as I did in January this year, or last November actually, to be here again, it just feels like a different world. Light and air and human spaces for people. The students seem so much happier and engaged. It's honestly, it makes just a huge difference. So, good on Dean Pobinsky.
Can you say more about the chair in feminist legal studies?
Yeah, well, it started off being the chair in women and the law, and then later the academic vice president suggested we change the name to be what it is now, and we did. Joe Smith, actually, was the leading proponent. Have you heard about Joe Smith?
I've heard about him.
Yeah.
Is he someone we...
Yeah, you should interview Joe, absolutely. He was a faculty member for a long time, from maybe 19... He was a faculty member when I was in law school, so he was a faculty member from then until he retired maybe 10 years ago. Well, he was hit by mandatory retirement. So, actually, he retired when I was dean, so that was back in the 90s. But Joe was... he used to teach jurisprudence, and then he took a great interest in feminist theory. And he wrote about feminist theory, taught it, and he got the idea that we should have a chair in Women and the Law. And I recruited some people to help raise the money. Risa Levine on the Court of Appeal was one. Michael O'Keefe was another. And we went out and raised some money, and now there's a chair. It was not necessarily an easy sell, but people came through, and I don't think probably the chair is I don't think the chair has quite enough money to cover everything that it needs to do, but it's doing okay.
Mm-hmm. And how do you I keep thinking of your of you as a clerk in that large, in the judge's chambers at the courthouse, and so you ended up there. How did that work? How did you become a judge in, I've got the date here somewhere.
Yeah, 98, I was appointed. Well, nowadays, and this was the case then too, you have to apply to be a judge. Mm-hmm. You put in an application, and it goes through an advisory committee that makes recommendations to the Minister of Justice, federal, and then either you get a call or you don't. So that's what happened. Now, why did I want to do it? Well, because it would be a new career. I've had a great opportunity to practice and then teach and then go to the bench, so to sample all of the more interesting aspects of the possible life of a lawyer. I mean, there are other things obviously that are interesting too that I haven't done, like be corporate counsel or something, but you know, practice, teaching, and judging, pretty good opportunity. So that's what I wanted to do, and I knew enough about it because my husband had been a judge for 4 years by the time I applied, so I knew the realities of it. And I'd been involved in judicial education. The National Judicial Institute does continuing education for Canadian judges, and I'd been teaching in their program for, 7 or 8 years by the time I applied to be a judge. So I knew what I was getting into, and it was great.
Do you have to write a letter? Do you send a CV? Is it a...
Well, you send a CV and there's an application form. And they check reference. I mean, they talk to people in the community and you give references. And that's it.
And then what was the first thing they did? Do they give you I don't even know what to call it, a case?
Yes, you're
put you in a chair and say a bench and put you to work.
Well, yes. In fact, even before your official ceremony where you're welcomed, you'll be sworn in by the Chief Justice. You take your oaths of office and then you start sitting right away. The first case I sat on was a family law case. They try to be a little gentle with you when you're just a new judge, so they try to give you a trial with lawyers as opposed to a trial with in-person litigants. And they try to give you, you know, they're they're not going to throw you into a hugely complex murder trial on your first week. This family trial.
Who's they? Who makes that decision?
Oh, that's a good question. It's the, well, in the end, it's the job of the Chief Justice, but the Associate Chief Justice has some delegated responsibility, and then the trial coordinator, in turn, carries out their directions.
And who was the Chief Justice?
When I was appointed, it was Brian Williams.
You probably can't say very much about the specifics, but was it work you enjoyed?
Oh, yes, very much, very much. Many aspects of it. First of all, the human interest, hearing people's stories, realizing how momentous what's happening is for them and how awesome your responsibility is. You know, so although I think sometimes judges, when they're appointed, worry that they're going to have to fight to stay awake or it's going to get really tedious, actually I never found that. I don't know, it's so important what you're doing, and you're taking notes, you're trying to follow everything. And the beauty of being the judge is that if you don't hear something or if you're not understanding a witness, you can make them stop and say, no, hang on, that didn't make sense to me, say that again. So you have to get it, and you can make them make it clear to you. So that's one aspect, the human interest and just having this very significant responsibility. Second, you sometimes get really fascinating legal issues. So I had the opportunity to sit on cases that involved very significant and intricate, difficult legal questions. Some charter cases, some civil cases, Aboriginal rights cases. And then, you know, it's a very collegial environment. Judges are very collegial, at least in our court. It's quite a joy to work with such a group. And then you have law clerks, so you have some younger people around, and we recruit law clerks to come and work with us.
You just retired last year, so it must be quite fresh in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the, I suppose it's public, your judgments are public records, so mm-hmm. Are there any you can talk about, any favorites or significant ones?
Well, I suppose the one that I put the most intensive long-term effort into was the Carter case, which was the assisted suicide case.
Mm-hmm. Which was just last year, I think.
That's right. That last June, I issued my judgment.
Yeah, 396 pages.
I'm afraid so. It was under 400, though.
Sounds like a dissertation.
It was like a dissertation. It was absolutely like a dissertation.
Did you have to go into to look at the example of other places that had enacted legislation? Right?
Well, counsel led evidence about the experience in other jurisdictions, and in the judgment I discussed that at some length. Yep. In a trial, of course, it's what counsel puts before you that you take into account. So when I said it was like a dissertation, it was unlike it in one very important respect, and that is counsel are doing the research and bringing it to you. And in fact, as a judge, you should not go outside what counsel bring before you. You're limited to those boundaries.
Well, that must make it easier in a way.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't have to go and do your own.
No. Nope. You have to understand it.
And you have to trust that they've done the work and found the relevant material.
Correct. Now, if something comes to your attention that they've missed and you think it's important, as a judge, you can call counsel back or send them a memo and say, look, I've come across this. What about it? You know, give me submissions on this, especially if it's a case.
So can that happen at the at any stage in the
Yes, it can.
Decision?
Yes, it can. But, you know, the principle that's important is that the judge should give counsel an opportunity to make submissions about evidence or theory or a case that might be of significance in the judge's reasoning. And so that's why normally you'd ask counsel to make submissions on the further item. If it's not important, I mean, if it's, you know, just another case in a line of cases, you wouldn't bother. But, yeah.
And the law clerks, can you ask them to help?
Yeah, if you think that, sure. I mean, what law clerks do is they'll do research as directed by the judge. So you might ask the clerk in a given case, if you think maybe counsel hasn't had time to do all the research that's needed, you might ask the clerk to go out and see, what have they missed? So the clerk will give you a memo, and if there's something significant, well, that's when you then ask counsel to give you further submissions. The clerk also might give you a memorandum about a particular legal issue in the case. The clerk might do some copy editing on the judgment. Those are the main things. Clerks also sometimes help with, if you're giving a lecture or a paper at a conference or something, you might help with that.
So we got lots of help if you need it.
Well, I wouldn't say lots. I mean, on our court, or that is on the BC Supreme Court, it's usually 5 or 6 judges to 1 clerk. So I wouldn't say lots of help. The Supreme Court of Canada, they have, I think, 3 clerks per judge plus, you know, quite a staff of lawyers. So,
as a layman, I think of judges kind of looking at you, at the witnesses critically, and to ascertain their guilt or read their mind or see if they have a clear conscience, that sort of thing. Was there any of that? Did the lawyers have a reputation? I'm not quite sure what I'm asking, but how do you, I should go to law school, I suppose, how do you decide? What are some of the factors that go into a decision?
In terms of assessing the evidence, if you've heard live witnesses, you might take into account the manner of testifying, but usually that's not a significant factor. You look at whether what the witness has said is consistent with other objective evidence, whether it's plausible, whether the witness has contradicted themselves, and so on. To some extent, the way they say it might matter, but there's a lot of warning from courts of appeal about over-reliance on demeanor. In terms of assessing arguments, some counsel have excellent reputations, and so if certain counsel get up and say, the law clearly is heading in the direction that X, or there's no instance where a court has Y, with certain counsel, you would almost take them at their word. I mean, you know that they're careful, that they wouldn't say that unless they'd actually looked, and so on. Other counsel, or counsel you don't know, not so much. So it all depends.
And you can always go and check up their their arguments.
Yeah.
Sounds fascinating. Sounds fun.
Oh yeah, no, it's very interesting. It's a great job. It's not a trivial workload. It's a very demanding job, but a terrific one.
Would you go back? Is that it for your
Oh, well, I think I've done that.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it mightily, but I retired because I was ready to do something more academic, I think, and do a little teaching of young students.
So how much teaching are you doing now?
Well, just one seminar, charter litigation seminar. But I'm going to help out with some of the moots as well. And I'm doing some writing. I'm writing a book chapter that I've done before with my co-author, Bill Black. We're doing a chapter on Section 15 equality rights in a book on the charter.
That's a question I was going to ask. We've been asking the people we've interviewed what the biggest change they've seen in their career has been, and what about the charter? I suppose that's a pretty big question.
Yeah. Well, sure. It's made an enormous change, particularly in the criminal law. It's transformed the criminal law. I mean, you know, frankly, I think one of the biggest changes is the result of technology. The information overload that now exists in law. It used to be that cases that were reported in the law reports were selected by editors. They'd be selected because they were of some significance. Maybe novel facts or a new point of law. They'd be selected and put in the law reviews. And other decisions just kind of vanished. Now, every decision, written decisions, oral decisions that get published, they're all there. And so, it's obviously a strength and a weakness at the same time. You can go on QuickLaw and find a case that supports almost any proposition, but how do you know if it's right? Well, you can see if other cases have followed it and so on, but there's just so much. It is like a fire hose of information spewing out, very different from the time when, there might be a new DLR and a new Western Weekly Report and a new BCLR and be about that much.
How do you focus with all this wide nozzle of information?
Yeah, well, I think that's a problem. I think it's a problem for young lawyers. I think young lawyers think, well, if I can find 27 cases that all say the same thing, I've done a brilliant job of research. But in my opinion, that's not a useful way to do it. But it's harder to focus. In fact, some young lawyers haven't even figured out that it's a good idea to go and look at one of the texts to see what the principles are before just putting in a huge binder full of cases. I don't mean to be complaining about, it's not just young lawyers either. I don't mean to be complaining about lawyers. I mean, it's an inevitable outcome of the information deluge.
What's wrong with finding cases that support a position? Is it that they're from other jurisdictions or lower courts or
no, it's fine. It's just that if you find one or two that are similar to the one that you're thinking about, you don't need 27.
Oh.
That was my point.
So yeah. It's information overload and it's
right.
Just too much.
Right. And then it's not just finding cases that are similar, it's thinking about what principles they embody and what principle you're asking the judge to follow. Maybe I shouldn't blame the information overload and the technology. Maybe it's something else, but it's certainly something that judges have commented on for some time now. So I think it's a big change. I mean, when I was in law school, this sounds ridiculous, but there weren't fax machines. So. I remember when fax machines came in and suddenly you could get a Supreme Court of Canada decision the same day. You didn't have to wait for 2 weeks for the mail to arrive.
We heard, that was at Tom Shorthouse, I think, who, when we interviewed him, he talked about these people that in the library, they'd be writing in the margins of the
Now, what would those be?
Yeah, annotating.
Annotations of them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. This beautiful, tiny, little crabbed handwriting. I know. It was lovely.
Very kind of 19th century.
Yep. Yep.
Well, we could. I suppose we should think about winding up. But are there any other people? Can think of anyone else we should talk to? We've talked to Leon Gatz.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Twice. He was so
good. Good.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. No, Leon's terrific. Well, let me think about people that you might not have thought of. Are you just doing kind of older people like Leon and me?
Well, we've put a. We're trying to get at the very 1940s class.
Oh, okay.
Found
even older.
Yeah, three or four of them. There's a guy who's 92 who was actually pre Bailey, someone Bailey. Who is, he calls himself the class of 1947, and he's pre-law school.
Right.
He articled downtown. He was a student here, but...
Did he get one of our honorary degrees when we had the 1995?
I'm not sure.
Do you know about those?
No.
Well, it was really nice. We had the 50th anniversary in 1995, and part of the celebration was... We conferred LLBs on people who had become lawyers in the province before there was a law school.
Hmm.
And so we found all these, they were all guys, and they were so thrilled to get an LLB. We had a convocation down in the courthouse, the whole university turned out in robes, and...
I'll ask him.
Yeah, because he would have been one of the people... Because you could become a lawyer without going to law school prior to 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Or 48, whatever it was. That
45, and then...
Yeah.
But that meant the first class was the class of 48.
Yeah. So people that you might want to interview. So you're trying for the earlier days.
Yeah, we're trying... we want to... The criteria include diversity. They include a chronological range. We want people from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s.
70s. Are you going into the 80s?
Well, 90s? We are, but I don't think we have yet.
We've had
one or two younger people mentioned.
Yeah.
Who we should talk to.
Okay.
But if you can't think of them now, just send them.
Sure. I'll send you a list.
Mm-hmm. Do, please.
And great. You'll do what you want with it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, pleasure. Pleasure. Well, I did take up more time than I thought. I guess it's the way it happens, isn't it?
Yes.
Nothing like talking about...